Seagrass.
Yeah, that's all right.
It's a little, tiny little boat.
Be a comfy fit, that's all right.
I'm with Mike Rashid, a principal scientist at James Cook University. We're on a wharf loading some gear and ourselves into an aluminium runabout where Mike's research team is waiting.
Hello.
Hi,
sorry,
I'm Joel.
Hi,
how are you?
I'm Katie. Good, how are
nice
you?
Nice to meet you.
If there's anywhere you
like. Yeah, is that all right?
Jacqueline?
Hi, I'm Joel. How are you?
Nice to meet you.
And Mark.
Hi, Mark.
How are you? Joel.
Good.
Did you have a nice trip over?
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's such a lovely morning. Yeah.
As soon as we're on board, Mark fires up the outboard and we follow a set of GPS coordinates that code the location of a white marker buoy. We're about 10 minutes out to sea when...
Yep. Right in front of us. Just about run over it.
Hey, there it is. That was well spotted. It just looks like it's a bit of weed.
Most people come to the Great Barrier Reef for the coral, but not these guys. Their focus is fixed on a different element of the marine ecosystem, one, like coral, both beautiful and fragile. Hi, I'm Joel Werner and you're tuned in to Off Track here on RN. The wharf we just left behind was crowded with hundreds of tourists. It's the main jetty on Green Island, a coral cay 27 kilometres offshore from Cairns in far north Queensland. The crew I'm with today are prepping for a dive to monitor some experiments that they've got set up 18 metres below us on the sea floor. The experiments they're conducting are on a plant that's at once both strange and familiar.
Well, seagrass is a marine plant. It's a flowering plant, like a lot of land plants. It actually produces flowers underwater and pollen, a lot like your land plants, and can reproduce underwater. I guess it's quite similar to, I guess, people's lawns in some respects. It also grows by runners and stuff as well. So, yeah.
And you talk about seagrass meadows, much in the same way you'd talk about a meadow, a terrestrial meadow. You talk about meadows underwater.
So it's grass, it forms meadows, some as high as a metre or more high, some very short, like on a football field.
This is Peter McCready, a research fellow at UTS. Like Mike, Pete's a seagrass expert.
And it is home to so many animals. You know, it's home to fish populations, it gives them nursery grounds, gives them food, shelter, protection from predators.
They're really productive, they provide food for a lot of animals, particularly up here, you know, dugong and turtle graze on them. Probably a little different to the land-based things. They're also really important habitats for lots of commercial species like prawns and juvenile fish. And
it stabilises our coastline and prevents coastal erosion, so it basically just holds our coast together. And in fact, in Australia, we've got more seagrass than anywhere else in the world. It's on every continent except Antarctica, but in Australia we've got an area roughly the size of Tasmania. And it also filters nutrients and traps particles from the water column, and that stops waters from becoming effectively toxic. We call it eutrophication. When you get the algae taken off, the seagrasses basically stop that from happening. They keep the water basically oxygenated. They're almost like the lungs of the sea. The same way trees do this on land, they do it in the oceans.
They grow very quickly, the tropical species especially, so there's big turnover of biomass that they're producing, which drives a lot of the productivity of marine ecosystems in this area.
So where are seagrass found?
Being plants, they need light, so they tend to be in the shallow areas of the ocean. So, you know, you get a lot of seagrass growing coastally.
You won't find them on a surf beach, for example. You might find bits washed up, but they tend to be in lower energy zones, so tend to be where we urbanise our planet. A lot of the coast around Australia, you find it in the kind of place where you want to moor your yacht or walk down to the place where your kids can play in the water without being knocked over by waves. They're the kind of places where it exists.
But also, you know, up here where we are at the moment, we're in 18 metres of water and quite a way offshore. So as long as you've got light, then seagrasses do penetrate to a deeper depth as well. Deep water seagrasses are dominated by a genus of seagrass called Holophila. They also grow in shallow water, but they're particularly well adapted to lower light conditions. So you can imagine the deeper you go, the less light penetrates. So you need to be really good at dealing with low light conditions. So you tend to get those species growing at the deep water areas. And Queensland's got a good diversity of seagrasses. Arguably, depending on which taxonomist you're talking to at the time, there's probably around 17 species that occur in Queensland. And they're quite diverse. I think a lot of people just assume seagrass is one thing, but that's a mistake because they all have different tolerances and requirements, and they will be impacted differently by things because of the way they grow.
But it's deep water seagrass that we're here to investigate today.
Very little is known about it because most focus on seagrass has been on the shallow coastal stuff that people see a lot of. And we think that the deep water seagrasses probably play a pretty important role. So we've established a program looking at deep water seagrasses in the tropics on the east coast, trying to understand what makes them tick, what makes them grow, what their tolerances and thresholds are. They're quite interesting in the sense that they can be annuals, like there's big parts of the year where they're just not there at all and they come back from seed, and we really have not a great understanding of what drives that process.
And it's Katie Chartrand's PhD that's trying to understand that process.
We've pulled up to our mooring at a deep water seagrass research site that we have set up here for the past year and a half. It's one of three that we have set up and down the coast where we're looking at deep water seagrass dynamics. Basically, my focus is on the photophysiology of deep water seagrass, which basically means I'm trying to understand the light dynamics and the available light that seagrasses are getting down at some of these deeper conditions that we see here, and how that's affecting their ability to photosynthesize and be able to maximize on those conditions. At a location like this, where the grass is growing down around 15 meters, and we get some of these species down to even up to 60 meters here in the Great Barrier Reef Lagoon, you have a loss of a large portion of the typical spectrum of light that's available to plants in shallow water or plants that you see on the surface. So basically, you lose things like the reds and the yellows and those portions of the light spectrum, and you're left with only the blues. And how that plant's able to adapt and maximize its efficiency to harvest that light energy and put that into plant material is basically the focus of my work.
So the plants out here are species that have adapted differently to the plants you find closer to shore.
That's right. Some of these species are found shallower as well, so they have some sort of plasticity to them to be able to adapt to those changing conditions, where other species are mainly found only in these deep water conditions. And it's a big unknown in an area of research that hasn't really been investigated yet as to how they're able to adapt to that.
Now, I'm holding you up from getting your wetsuit on just before you do that. What are you going to do today in terms of specifics?
Well, we have a number of different elements to the project. One is just looking at how much seagrass is there, what's the density of seagrass on the site, as well as looking at some of its reproductive capacity. So we're measuring the seed bank and measuring how much it's able to produce, and looking at that seasonally. So we come out to the site monthly to be able to get a handle on those dynamics. As well, I'm going into more of the detailed profiling of the light climate that they're receiving. So I'll be doing some spectral profiling to break down what wavelengths that we're getting on site, as well as measuring some of the efficiencies of the plant to harvest that light. So what I use is called a pulse amplitude modulated fluorometer, which is a fancy name for something that's measuring how efficient the plant is at photosynthesizing. So that's my role this morning.
Well, I won't hold you up any longer. I'll let you get ready to have it on.
No worries, thanks.
So to carry out this research, a team of three dive 18 metres to the sea floor. And it's not just an air tank and flippers they take down. There's a huge amount of gear that gets submerged along with the scientists. And a lot of it is quite innovative. So, at the moment, Mark's holding what looks like a digital camera in a shoebox-sized Perspex casing.
Basically, what they are is they're a SLR camera and a housing that's been sort of modified with a brush, which will actually swipe the face of the camera about once every half an hour or so. And it just stops the fouling on the front of the lens. So these sit in tripods, which are facing down at a 50 by 50 centimetre quad wrap. And they take three photos a day. So one at 9 o'clock, one at 12 o'clock, and one at 3 o'clock. And we've had them out there doing that for a bit over a year now. So we just keep switching them out. And you end up getting basically a time series of the grass coming and going. We'll actually use those photos to go back and we do a visual estimate of biomass, so we'll assess how much grass there is in the different quadrants at different times of year. So because it comes and goes. So
it's an awesome piece of equipment. You'd love to be a tourist diver and dive to the bottom and randomly find a...
That was discussed.
Are they bike locked in or something? Yeah,
we don't advertise them very well on the surface. But, no, what Mark didn't say is he basically, him and one of the other guys in our team, designed these from scratch and ran out, built them up. There's a lot of development work that went into those. And
Development work, you mean a lot of mistakes?
Well, you know, trial and error.
How many cameras have you lost?
That's a really sensitive question right now.
Four. Four's not too bad.
Yeah, no, I flooded two, and the last time I went out, two got caught in the current and just disappeared off the face of the earth. So someone down in Mackay got two nice cameras and two nice boxes floating up on the beach somewhere.
There are temperature buds.
Yeah.
If you want to attach those...
Temperature
buttons
as well to go out?
Yes.
They're in here? Oh, yep.
Katie, you were mentioning temperature buds before. Uh-huh. They seem to be self-explanatory, but can you explain what they are in here?
Sure. Basically, they're just small loggers that we use to record temperature at the site, along with light. That's one of the other primary drivers of seagrass abundance and distribution. So we're trying to get a handle on that fluctuation throughout the year and how that might stimulate germination at certain times of year and also potentially affect their die-off that naturally occurs with the onset of the wet season and buildup of warm temperatures into the summertime. So we do that both here at our deep water sites and also along the coast at some of the intertidal sites where you have also seagrass exposed to really high temperatures that you get during the midday. So that's part of the grand scheme.
In terms of the way you collect the data, is it essentially setting up the equipment, letting it run for a month, say, and then coming back out, and that's when you retrieve the data? It doesn't get transmitted remotely somewhere else?
That's right. It's a bit of quality control to come out monthly and just ensure that we haven't had any damage to the loggers and that we have been able to collect the information that we need, so we download and put out fresh loggers monthly. There is a lot of fouling that occurs at the sites. The site here at Green Island isn't too bad, but our location down off Mackay has a great deal of growth that happens over a very short period, so it's important to get out there and make sure that we maintain that information and we don't lose any of the crucial data. There's actually a site map that I can put in to that folder, I believe.
Oh, there we go. That's excellent.
What is that?
You made a grill.
Right.
So some of the camera modifications have meant they don't fit in the housings properly anymore. So rather than try and sort it out on the surface, I was just going to take a tank down and just move a couple of holes around and hopefully save a little bit of time. You're a bit restricted with the amount of dives you can do, and if you can get something done on the bottom, it's often a bit better than doing it on top.
You're listening to Off Track here on RN. I'm Joel Werner, and today we're all out at sea, 27 kilometres out to sea, offshore of Cairns in far north Queensland. With his team underwater, I take a moment to catch up with JCU Principal Scientist Mike Rashid.
So Mike, the rest of your team's now at 18 metres carrying out the research. Any jealousy, any wish you were down there feelings at the moment?
Oh, absolutely. It's always better to be underwater than sitting on top waiting for them to come back.
Can you describe for the listener what it's like at 18 metres doing this research?
It's actually nice and peaceful down there for those people that haven't done much diving before. You know, there's no one talking to you. There's the sound of your bubbles and your own thoughts. It's almost like meditation.
We saw you pointing on the map before. So there's a series of plots down there. So will they go from plot to plot doing their work?
Yeah. So there's a setup looking at how seagrass changes over time. So we've got permanent plots that we go to, and they'll go around and take photos of the seagrass and then do counts of how many shoots there are and measurements of the seed banks and a whole range of measurements they're doing underwater. We've got a mixture of things that we're doing out here, and we have monitoring, which is obviously pretty important, but we've got quite a suite of experimental studies that we're looking at.
We've been studying seagrass for ages, for a really long time, I guess you could say they've become sexy recently because of this blue carbon sink capacity.
Peter McCready and Mike Rashid work for different universities on different research projects, but all to achieving the same end, enhancing our understanding of seagrass, and especially its capacity to store carbon.
So blue carbon is basically carbon that is captured and stored by the oceans. And it was only a few years ago that there was a report released by some European groups that had done a really good job of demonstrating that seagrasses are one of the most powerful carbon sinks on the planet. So they capture and store carbon at a rate about 40 times faster than tropical rainforests like the Amazon. But what for me was really significant in that report, what really made the seagrasses or demonstrated their ability to be powerful carbon sinks, was that it showed that they can store the carbon for thousands of years. And the reason that's important is that when we're trying to find systems that are good at sequestering carbon, like rainforests in Australia, we've got the Carbon Farming Initiative, which was brought in by the Labor government. This is about converting farmlands back into forests that can capture and store carbon to try and slow and reverse climate change. These terrestrial systems usually only store carbon for decades, maybe centuries at most. You can imagine a tree is holding a lot of carbon in its trunk. It falls over, it degrades. You're going to get 100 years out of that carbon mainly from being locked away. Whereas with the seagrasses, they store it in the sediments beneath them, and they represent effectively a limitless potential to store because they accrete sediments layer upon layer. In Sydney Harbour, for example, we found that seagrasses have been storing carbon for up to 8,000 years. So a very long-term carbon sink is what they're known for recently. You know, in Australia, we've lost a lot of our seagrass. Globally, there's been about a 30% loss of seagrasses. And the big concern is that you've got this ancient carbon, this carbon that has been stored in the sediments for thousands of years, leaking back out into the atmosphere and accelerating climate change. I mean, what we've got here is a plant doing what plants have always done, biosequestration, capturing and storing carbon from the atmosphere. This is ironic. It's the same process that created fossil fuels in the first place. It's almost like Mother Nature giving us another chance to try and take control of our climate. But we're making things worse by potentially releasing all that carbon they've been stored. We do the same thing when we dig up coal and other fossil fuels. But let's look at what systems we have out there at the moment that can sequester carbon, do this thing called biosequestration, that can do it effectively and help us fight climate change, because we can only do so much to curb industry emissions and other human emissions. So this is about nature-based climate mitigation, effectively.
A lot of the seagrass research that both Peter and Mike's groups carry out occurs further south of here in Gladstone, the port known quite infamously for its extensive dredging development. Peter McCready.
So the Gladstone work, we're putting down shade cloths which reduce light availability for the seagrasses. And effectively by doing that, we're mimicking something like dredging, where there's light limitation that typically causes the death of that seagrass. So we're mimicking that process, and then we're measuring whether or not the carbon is being lost from the ground once you lose that above ground plant material. And then how much is vulnerable? Is it just the top few centimetres, or are we talking hundreds of years of carbon that's been accumulated being lost in the course of a year or two? These are the kind of questions we're trying to address. In 6 to 8 weeks of those shade cloths being on there, the seagrass will be dead. It'll be gone. And so I can appreciate the need for humanity to prevail in industry and to make money and to move forward and to allow our economies to develop. But we need to be able to make decisions that can hopefully minimise environmental impacts at the same time. So what we would really like to be doing is advising dredging companies on when to stop dredging to minimise impacts to the seagrasses. And the impacts are often recognised too late. It takes usually dugongs and turtles to wash up on the beach dead before people start to realise that, wait a minute, we lost a lot of seagrass. This is now having flow-on effects for the rest of the food chain, or fish stocks to decline in a fishery 3 or 4 years later sometimes. And we're trying to help people recognise that by protecting natural habitats, you're often saving money in the process. You're keeping ecosystem services that are worth a lot of money. Things like nutrient cycling, carbon capture and storage, fisheries value, shoreline stabilisation. And it's often once something's gone, that we are then prepared to put our dollars in bringing back the system. But something that has happened is that the systems have often lost their resilience. When I say 6 to 8 weeks, we're talking about you look down and you can't see any more plant material. If we're lucky, there is still some roots beneath that can reform shoots if we remove the shade cloths. But if we left the shade cloths on longer, those roots would eventually disappear. And if there's no seeds left in the ground, then you really have very little chance of repopulating the area that's been disturbed. If there is surrounding seagrass, sometimes you can get encroachment of the surrounding seagrass into the bare area. If there's no surrounding seagrass, you rely on seeds from distant populations. But if your distant populations have also suffered tough times as well, you have Buckley's chance of getting your seagrass back. When you lose the seagrass, they end up in this vicious feedback loop where the water becomes turbid and there's a lot of scouring of the sediments, and you find it very difficult to get the system back to the way it once was. Some restoration programs are costing up to $1 million per hectare to restore the seagrass. It can be very expensive. We're finding cheaper ways, but it's still very, very expensive. The other thing we're doing is, with the shade cloth experiments, we're seeing morphological changes, loss visually of the plant material. That is not really acceptable when we want them to be rapid in responding to dredging activities. We want something better than that. So we considered physiological changes, changes in, for example, the photosynthesis of the plant. Can we look at the happiness of the plant effectively to indicate whether dredging needs to cease or slow? We want to take it even one step further, which is to look at molecular changes. Can you see a change in the expression of certain genes that would indicate whether or not the plant is functioning well? And the other extension for us is looking at, if the seagrass recovers, can it cap the carbon from being lost from the sediments? And dredging is just one process we're looking at. Earlier this year in February, I was in Jervis Bay looking at the effects of the seismic testing that was done in the 1960s for building a nuclear testing facility in Jervis Bay National Park. What impact has the bomb testing for that program had on the below ground carbon? We're also looking at the effects of eutrophication as well. We published a study last year that looked at Botany Bay. It was a great site to look at when humans first started impacting our seagrass meadows. They arrived and started chopping down trees and polluting the waters and doing what humans do. And we know that there was a loss of seagrass from the historical records. And we said, well, how has that impacted the carbon sink capacity of Botany Bay? And we found that since European settlement, we saw this dramatic shift from a system that was sequestering carbon through powerful means, through the seagrasses, through other blue carbon habitats like salt marshes and mangroves. And then there was this shift to a system that was using microalgae. And these microalgae bury carbon with an efficiency 1/100th of what the seagrasses do. So a dramatic weakening, a 100-fold weakening in the capacity of that system to sequester carbon.
How was it down there today?
It's good. A little bit chilly, but really nice visibility. Success.
Over the year, we see typical growth spurts and declines that fall in line with wet season and dry season trends and temperatures. The species that you get here are very ephemeral in nature, so they're fleeting. They typically rely on their seed bank, so they put out a lot of seeds to be able to reproduce and come back every year. So the seagrass tends to come back over that dry season. So once conditions have started to calm, the water clarity has started to improve following the wet season flood events, temperatures starting to warm up. So towards the late end of the dry season, leading into the wet season, along the coast, you see the natural peaks in seagrass. We do see similar trends with the deep water grasses as well at this stage, but it is a bit early to say if that holds true.
Well, you're obviously cold, so I'll let you get changed. Thank you. So, Katie, you're up and you're warm. You brought up some data that's been collecting there over the past month.
That's right. We brought up what are called sondes, and they're collecting information on the conductivity, which tells us a bit about the salinity trends that we're seeing at the site, as well as temperature and light.
So can you take us through what the process for you is now? Do you take that back to your lab, upload it, start analysing it? Or?
Yep, so we take it back, download the data, and we also have to do a quality control and assessment to make sure that we have accurate data to represent what we're running through our analysis with.
I think it's my new favourite word, but you mentioned this idea of fouling today, that the equipment gets fouled. how was it when you just went down?
It wasn't too bad. There definitely was some growth over some of the loggers. We have a logger right here just to give you an idea. Yeah. So it's covered in quite a bit of algal growth and other things, bryozoans and sponges that attach onto that. We even have some little a little crab that just fell off there. This has been out for approximately 3 months to 4 months now. So, as I said, this actually isn't all that much growth. Other sites, we have barnacles that are coating the entire thing after only 2 weeks. It also becomes actually quite dangerous handling them, very sharp. Have to have gloves on to be able to even collect and manipulate the sons.
Katie Chartrand. You also heard from Mike Rashid, Peter McCready and Mark Leith, giving us a glimpse inside the world of seagrass. And that's it for this week. Until next time, bye for now.